I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. A decade ago, psychologist Angela Duckworth wrote the best-selling book Grit, about how persistence and passion can lead to long-term success. More recently, she's discovered that willpower alone is often not enough. Rather, our surroundings and the people we surround ourselves with can help us reach our goals. She's written a new book, and it's titled Situated: Find the People and Places That Bring Out Your Best. In it, she writes about her mother, a gifted artist who was born in China. Raising her family and running a business was the situation that kept her mom from doing her art. There was no room set aside to paint, no colleagues to support her, no mentor to challenge her. The good news is now, in her 90s, Angela's mother is painting again because she changed her situation. Today on The Connection, how mobilizing external outside factors, even asking for help, can help us do hard things and realize our dreams. Angela Duckworth studies successful people. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a MacArthur Fellow and faculty co-director of the Penn Wharton Behavior Change for Good. And Angela Duckworth, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Marty, it's good to see you again.
I'm curious about what got you rethinking grit, because so much of your career, your identity, has been associated with that word and how you wrote about it. What got you thinking, well, maybe grit isn't enough?
Well, Marty, I spent the first half of my career studying the importance of individual effort. It's not just talent, it's individual effort that enables you to reach any goal. But I've turned my attention in the second half of my career to everything and everyone around you that makes effort pay off. It's not just the person, it's also their situation.
I wonder whether, and not to get too deeply psychological here, but your dad, who was also born in China, was very much what felt like a gritty guy.
You know, he
was all
guy.
About hard work and achievement, and you were a dutiful daughter. You did really well. You worked hard. You achieved. Do you think the kind of first part of your career is about your dad and the second part more about your mom?
The first part of my career and my first book is about my dad. The second half of my career and the second book is about, and I dedicated it to, my mom.
You did.
You know, my dad actually talked a lot about talent, but he really lived the gospel of trying harder. Nobody tried harder than my dad. He actually worked in the Philadelphia area back when DuPont was here on Grace Ferry, and a 35-year career. And I don't think they could have had a harder working scientist. He thought about his work all the time. And he did teach me something very important, which is that when you work consistently toward a goal, you can get so much farther than you think. That is an important lesson. Don't let, you know, lack of talent, for example, you know, keep you out of a game. But I think it's an incomplete message. And so the attention that I want to draw is to something people don't think you can change. It is your situation. I think when you're growing up and you hear, don't complain about your circumstances, make the best of your circumstances, the expression circumstances beyond our control, they kind of intimate that individual effort is 100% of what you should focus on. And the reality is, and I think the story of my mom is about how you can be really gritty and try hard and then try hard again and then try even harder. And if you are not in a situation that supports you, you will not achieve the goals you're trying to achieve.
You begin the book with a story about your mother. She's very much a part of this book. And you and she are swimming off the coast of Miami. You're dropped pretty far out into the ocean to swim together. And a current begins to really drag you and drag your mom, who is in her 80s at this point. She is near drowning, and you are, it sounds like you're quite a good swimmer. You thought, well, I'll try to save my mom, being the gritty.
I'll swim her to safety.
The gritty daughter that you are, and you realize, I cannot do it. And you have to, you know, wave your hands in the air and say, help.
Let me just acknowledge that the very idea of taking your 86-year-old mother snorkeling in the Atlantic Ocean right. is a remarkable act of, you know, situational lack of awareness,
right? Yes.
It was like, oh, you know, like, let's go snorkeling. But I think some awareness of the situation would have perhaps prevented all of this happening. But indeed, it's as you say, Marty, you know, it's true story. I have never felt that fear in my life. And when I tried to swim her to safety, and, you know, for much of my adult life, I swam an hour a day.
Wow.
And so, you know, not in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, but I know how to swim. And I kicked and thrashed and I did everything I could. And I think it very quickly dawned on me that I could not save her in this situation. So I had to change the situation, stop thrashing about as a swimmer, and just tread water, hold up her head with one hand, and signal for help, asking other people to help me change that situation. And I will say that there is some snorkeling instructor out in the world whose name is Jeff, who I have tried to track down. He was not our instructor. He was from a nearby boat. It saw that signal and, you know, directed his boat toward me, CPR, you know, a trip home at top speed to the port, emergency room, a miracle. You know, my mom is 91 now.
And she recovered.
My mother recovered fully. Yes, she recovered fully.
But you learned maybe a lesson, I mean, that's embedded in this book here.
You know, if you haven't been stranded in the ocean, you might not realize how powerful the ocean current is. But I think many of us have been in an ocean, and we know that a swimmer cannot beat the current, even if it's not, you know, off the coast of Miami, you know, on a very, very, very windy day. To me, the ocean is a metaphor for the situation. The situation is the water you swim in. And I think, like fish, we don't necessarily have awareness of that situation. I think, again, it's probably for multiple reasons, one of which is that we're taught that we can't change it. And indeed, why pay attention to something that you can't change? Focus on yourself. Control the controllables, a lot of coaches like to say. And I think my amendment of that, or my addition to that, is when you think about controlling the controllables, please include elements of your situation that you can change.
And I want to dig into situation, but let me ask you about how you see luck. Because in certain ways, there you are, you and your mom, alone in the Atlantic Ocean. As you say, the person that dropped you off had taken off. You had to find somebody. I mean, assuming he hadn't looked in your direction or hadn't heard you or hadn't seen your arms waving in the air. How do you see luck?
I think luck is, as the kids say, luck is a thing. You know, luck is not a figment of our imagination. There was good luck that day. And I want to say this about our situations and ourselves, because if you talk about what's outside of you and what's inside of you, again, I think a lot of people say, well, there's a lot of luck to what's outside of you. Where were you born? You know, who is in your family? You know, were you assigned a great kindergarten teacher? You know, what was the quality of your first boss? You know, how would you call them as a mentor on a scale from 0 to 10?
Sure.
Not all of those things are factors that you have agency over. So absolutely, there's luck. I would like to draw attention to the fact that there's luck to things on the inside. Some of us are walking around with a predisposition toward overeating and obesity. And some of us are not. And the list goes on, you know, depression, extroversion. So there's luck on the outside. There's luck on the inside. There are things that you can't control on the outside. And there are things that you don't have, like your DNA, can't control on the inside. But I will confess to this, Marty. I am the person, the psychologist, who is more interested in what you can change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to acknowledge what you can't. But I think on the inside and on the outside, alongside the factors that you can't change, are factors that you can.
You write about the fact that we like what's familiar. You know, makes us
status quo bias.
Yes,
we cling to familiar, but
well,
yeah, you're in for change.
Because it's familiar and we feel safe and comfortable. But we also have this part of ourselves that does want to change, maybe change things that have been bothering us about ourselves. How do we reconcile those two things?
Well, most people have at least one thing that they would like to change. I would like to go to bed a little earlier. I would like to have more of a morning routine where I am really present and not, for example, you know, scrolling on my phone too much. But by the way, I think according to my data, that's not just the morning. I mean, Americans feel like they're scrolling too much at pretty much any time of
Indeed.
Day and now evening.
Yep.
I think the question is, if there is something that you want to change, and not to say that anyone can mandate that for you. But if you just reflect and you think, yeah, there are some things I want to change, then I think you have to acknowledge something that psychologists call status quo bias. It's one of the major obstacles to any kind of personal change. And that is that we do cling to the familiar. There are plenty of research studies that show that when you acknowledge that eating a certain way or even making a decision that doesn't require self-control or willpower, even when it's just like, oh, how about option B? You've had option A for a while. Right. How about option B? You've lived here for a while. How about living in this neighborhood that you actually can't afford? You've been in this particular job for a while. It's maybe not the greatest fit for you. Have you explored other options? We have a tendency, and it is an irrational tendency. In other words, it is against our better interests often to stick with what we have and to not go for what's better. If you may allow me, I just wanted to say one, you know, sure. point about this on research. So Stephen Levitt, the economist who's, you know, half of the Freakonomics team, he's at University of Chicago. He got very interested in status quo bias. He had an intuition after studying human behavior as an economist that this was a bigger deal than people acknowledged. So he ran this flip the coin study where if it goes heads, you are asked to change something that you have thought about. And if it's tails, the opposite, stick with the status quo. So he's kind of randomly assigning you to change or not change. Of course, not everybody did it, but statistically, you know, more people in the heads group changed. And what he found is when he follows up months later, the people who changed really were happier with their lives. And I think that is some of the best evidence that status quo bias can be holding us back from a better way.
But just the flip of a coin, I mean, something as simple and subtle as that can put you on a different path. Thinking about change, I think we often want to change the other person, keep ourselves, you know, pretty much within a certain parameter. But it's the other person that needs to change.
A lot of advice about the other person is don't try to change the other person, right? And I think that needs to be unpacked, right? Because that sounds like, well, there's an aspect of your situation that you cannot change, right? Like, my husband keeps leaving his socks on the floor and it's, you know, driving me crazy. And maybe we need to just say, well, let him leave his socks on the floor because you can't change that person. I want to unpack that in a way that's more nuanced than a kind of like one-liner, you know, yes or no. I think there are aspects of other people, a lot of them, that you can't change. One thing you can change is how much time you spend with that other person. Now, with the husband, I think you're maybe not going to say like, oh, I'm going to reduce the amount of time I'm going to spend with you. But you actually might do other things like, you know, not spend time, you know, staring at those socks and, you know, obsessing about them. I think the point is that when you think about other people, it's true you cannot directly change their behavior, but there's always some agency.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Angela Duckworth, our guest today on The Connection. She's got a brand new book. It's called Situated, Find the People and Places That Bring Out Your Best. About 10 years ago, she wrote a best-selling book called Grit. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Angela Duckworth is our guest today on the show. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, she's got a new book we've been talking about called Situated, Find the People and Places That Bring Out Your Best. Well, from socks on the floor to Viktor Frankl, who an existential psychologist who survived Auschwitz, and thinking about someone's situation and the ability to either control or not control the situation. He wrote many things about what it was to survive Auschwitz that are so important, I think, for all of us today. But how do you factor in his view and what his life was like early on and how we either can or can't change our situation?
Every year when I teach students at Penn and at Wharton, I ask them, what's a book that's changed your life? And so often that book is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which I think you know, Marty, he wrote as a memoir of his time in the concentration camps. When people reference that book, the lesson that they take from it very often is you can't change your situation, but you can change how you respond to it. And that's because Viktor Frankl wrote that when you can't change your situation, you can change how you respond to it. He was reflecting on himself. He was also a great student of philosophy and had really internalized that message. But there's something else that Viktor Frankl wrote in Man's Search for Meaning that is very rarely quoted. I've never seen it quoted. He said, if you can change your situation, then you must, because otherwise it would be masochistic. And I hope that we can, in this age of one-liners and, you know, sort of like easy truths, you know, internalize a more complex message, which is that when you can't change your situation, you should try to change your thoughts and your behavior. But what Viktor Frankl, as a psychiatrist, understood, he was a psychiatrist before the concentration camps and then for his entire life afterwards, is that your thoughts and behavior are very much downstream of your situation. The situation will trigger certain thoughts. Those thoughts will motivate certain behaviors. So when you ask the question, how do I control myself? You know, how do I get what I want? How do I do what I want? Well, then you have to control your thoughts. But how do you control your thoughts? You control your situation. And I think that insight, Viktor Frankl clearly understood. And I hope that's the Viktor Frankl that we can appreciate today.
About surviving. And he was also an incredible observer, obviously, of other people as a psychiatrist, seeing amidst the horrors of Auschwitz that there was kindness and generosity, that people were choosing to use some of your language here, were choosing to do good things.
Let me tell you about the part of Man's Search for Meaning that I think people stop at. It is actually two books in one. The first part is a memoir. He actually wrote that over the course of 9 days. He was in a deep depression, actually, after Auschwitz. He lost his entire family, including his wife. And he would later say that, you know, writing this book was one of the things that saved him. But it is two books because that's half of the book. Half the book is his account of survival, his narrative of other prisoners who were kind, who were generous and brave. The other half is called Logotherapy in a Nutshell. That is literally what it's called, Logotherapy in a Nutshell. Viktor Frankl, before and after the camps, had a philosophy of life that was called Logotherapy. Logo means meaning. So yes, Nike has a logo and Starbucks has a logo, but the meaning of logo is meaning. And he believed that a life well lived is a meaningful life. And how this all gets back to what you were talking about, Marty, is that Viktor Frankl wanted us especially to improve the situations for other people. When you ask Viktor Frankl about depression, about anxiety, about existential angst, about insomnia, about suffering of any psychological kind, he said, the causes can be varied, but the cure is always the same, and that is to live your life to improve the situations of other people. So again, I feel like we have some appreciation of Viktor Frankl in contemporary society. I think if you really dig deeper, this is a man who understood the power of the situation. He understood the power of the individual to change his or her own situation, and he emphasized to his dying day the responsibility that we had for others. He said, America, you have a Statue of Liberty on the East Coast. What you need is a Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast. And that statue is actually it's underway, and it's not one hand raised to the sky with a flame. It's two hands, one hand reaching up for help, the other reaching down to give assistance.
Again, that's Angela Duckworth, our guest today on The Connection. You write, and it is so true, got me thinking about how different we are in different situations or with different people. You describe, and I think we can all connect to this idea, you go home to your parents, and lo and behold, you become a teenager again, no matter how old you are. And it is so interesting how place, you know, how, and familiarity can bring out different parts and sides of ourselves. I think we're different at work than we are at home. we're different with different kinds of friends because they bring out, again, different parts of ourself. How do you see that?
Let me reference a Philadelphian. Tim Beck lived much of his life in Philadelphia. He lived to 100. He lived in Rittenhouse Square in the condos there. And he is widely acknowledged as a founder, arguably the founder of cognitive therapy, right, really the bedrock of modern therapy. And towards the very end of Tim's very long career, he had the observation that we are different people in different situations. So yes, we have a work mode. Some of us have a vacation mode, a survival mode. It turns out when I returned to my Cherry Hill roots, to my parents', you know, wall-to-wall carpeted home, I would immediately click into teenager mode, right? Like just, you know, drinking Diet Coke and, you know, starfish style on the carpet, watching bad television. That never happened in my own home because I was in mom mode, right? And when I go to work, I'm in professor mode. What Tim said is that we think of this as a bug, but really it's a feature. It is an adaptive feature of human nature and a sign of mental health to be different selves in different places and with different people. Because he was the founder of cognitive therapy, of course, much of his life was thinking about depression and other illnesses, including schizophrenia. And what he said is that if you can get a person to be in what he liked to call their sweet spot, the circumstances that really bring out their best selves, the selves that they appreciate the most, the ones that they want to be showing up more often, then you have done the work. You don't need to have them argue with their thoughts or, you know, do much more other than to react naturally to a situation that is the best fit for their best selves.
Because I think it's so easy to think of someone with so many different parts of their personality as being a phony or a hypocrite because they behave differently with you than they do with me. But as you say, it's an adaptive thing to do.
I mean, there's this term code switching, which has, you know, different nuances or connotations. But I think for a lot of people, they're like, oh, code switching is bad or it's, you know, oppressive. But I do think we should understand that it's part and parcel of human nature to be lighthearted and optimistic in one circumstance and appropriately like sober and maybe not, you know, not humorous in another. And again, some of this is trivial, like, oh, yeah, when I'm with my mom, like I let her make my breakfast and I don't clear my dishes. Oh, and with my husband, I, you know, speak in a certain way. But I think that when we notice of ourselves, that there are good and bad ones, that there are good and bad ones according to us. I mean, here's a parable that Tim Beck loved, the parable of the two wolves. Tim would often try to explain this very deep concept. And he said, there is a grandfather and his grandson. And the grandfather says to his grandson, in me, there is a fight between two wolves, a good wolf and a bad wolf. And the good wolf is honest and kind and curious. The bad wolf is all the things I don't want to be, jealous and angry, insecure. And the grandson asks his grandfather, which will win? And the grandfather says, the wolf you feed. And I think Tim Beck was pointing us to the situations that bring out our good wolf and asking us to be aware of the situations that bring out our worst.
Part of that is knowing yourself, knowing that there are these various wolves, to use that metaphor, but also the ability to read the room and to sort of know that home is different from school.
Situational awareness, right? Yes. Does this, you know, you're a fish. The water you swim in, you may not be thinking about it. It's definitely influencing you because there is a current and there are different waters, right? So just notice how I am in this place versus how I am in another. Marty, I just want to tell you, I was on a conference call once and I was in work mode. And so I was using this tone of voice and it's like about a half octave lower than I use with my friends or my family. And then I thought I had hung up, but apparently I hadn't. And then I just started talking to my husband. And the colleagues that I had on the phone call said, wait, who's that other person who joined? And so, and then I realized what happened. I was like, oh, that's me, but it's just another self.
Indeed. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Angela Duckworth, our guest today on The Connection. She's a psychology professor at the University of Pennsylvania, wrote a book about a decade ago called Grit. And I keep saying that because that is in part how so many people know Angela Duckworth. She's got a new book. It takes grit into the next level, and it's called Situated, and it's subtitled Find the People and Places That Bring Out Your Best. You write about your marriage in this book, and it sounds like you and your husband work really hard. I mean, if I can use the word gritty again, you know.
Yes, I think the young people gritty, call it tryhards.
Yeah, we were tryhards. You worked really hard raising children, your own careers, and you were lonely. You felt like you really didn't have a partner or a mate or someone you could share your emotional life with. What was going on? What do you think was going on with the two of you?
I mean, the first part of our marriage and our romance really was a fairy tale. We were both strivers. I mean, we recognized grit in each other. I think that's one reason we were drawn to each other. And every challenge that Jason and I had in life, physical, intellectual, professional, personal, we did what we knew how to do, which is we just tried harder. I mean, that's how we got everywhere we got. You know, neither of us were labeled as, you know, the genius in our classes. And look, the magic of trying harder worked until it didn't work. And what happened to us at a period in our marriage, we were young parents. Our daughters were healthy and wonderful, but we had parenting. We also had, both of us at the same time, professional challenges that were new. I was on tenure track at Penn. All of my studies were coming up failures. Suddenly, this like string of success was coming to a very ungraceful end. Jason was managing a company that did real estate development during the financial crisis. I think what happened is that we relied then on our just try harder mantra. And what happened is we were both burning out. And this fairy tale romance was joyless. I mean, you know, I just felt like every day it was like two soldiers in a foxhole. Mm. And I think for me, the unhappiness, the weight of it, I didn't pause to consider that maybe we were fighting, you know, to succeed in a losing situation, and that we had to do what I did in the middle of the ocean with my mom, which is to change the situation by asking for help. It's not something that we were raised to do, and it's not something that we liked to do. And I will tell you, Marty, it's still something that I find hard to do.
To ask for help?
To ask for help. But yeah, I told Jason that we should probably split up. And, you know, to make a much longer, more dramatic story shorter, I will say that he refused to accept that answer, and that we went to therapy for the first time.
You had three therapists at one point.
Oh my God. We had three therapists. Jason said we should go to therapy. I immediately resisted. He not only thought that he should go to therapy, he thought that I should go to therapy. And then the two of us should go to a marriage counselor. You know, there was a great sucking noise of all the money being drained out of our bank account. And so there was not only the financial burden, but Marty, I was not raised to ask for help in that way. It was shameful, honestly, given how I'd grown up. But that change in the situation was, I cannot tell you, like, inestimably transformative. Talk about self-awareness. It's very difficult, I think, to have true self-awareness only by yourself. And not everybody has to go to a therapist. We found it extremely useful to have professionals who expertly guided us toward a level of awareness about ourselves, about how we had gotten to where we'd gotten, about our relationship. We also did other things. I'll just mention one. You know, for a lot of our lives, we thought we would rely on ourselves. You know, self-reliance is a very long tradition in the United States.
Sure. Bootstraps and all, right?
You know, you can do it. Like, you can be a self-made man. In this case, you know, I think professionally, both of us had an epiphany, which is that you will always do better if you are in a group versus trying to do something on your own. Now I'm talking about professionally, but of course the professional pressures were influencing our marital satisfaction. I, to this day, since that era, never do a scientific research project on my own. And I really mean that. There is, you know, if I'm working on AI, you know, my computer scientist colleague, Lyle Unger, if I'm working on cell phones, you know, my economist colleagues at Stanford and other schools. Jason, as a real estate developer, was still the president of his own company, but he joined this organization called Entrepreneurs Organization, EO for short. And now he had this kind of AA group, effectively, of other entrepreneurs also struggling, dealing with leadership issues, dealing with HR, dealing with, you know, work-family balance. The transformative event of our lives professionally, I think, was to realize that you can only get so far just trying harder on your own. You absolutely need a situation that includes other people who are striving alongside you.
You mentioned AA, and you write in the book that you had a college roommate who had a problem with alcohol, who went into AA, and which is obviously sharing your story and being with other people. And the mantra, I guess, of AA is that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection, just to underscore what you're saying there. It's other people.
You know, let's talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. I have studied human nature for 25 years as a psychologist, and I think all of us are students of human nature. I have never witnessed a more psychologically wise organization than Alcoholics Anonymous. There is a professor at Harvard Medical School. I believe he's like the first endowed chair of studying addiction. And I asked him, why do you study Alcoholics Anonymous? His name is John Kelly. And he said, well, you know, addiction is not a like sprained ankle. You don't get fixed. It's a lifelong challenge. So then I had to look for solutions that really could endure. And he studied the medications. He studied individual psychotherapy. He said, do you know what the most enduring and effective treatment for the lifelong addiction of alcoholism is? It is Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is effectively a circle of folding chairs in the basement of a local church. It's just alcoholics talking to other alcoholics, trying to be each other's supportive situation. So I do think this idea that the power of the group exceeds by far the power of the individual is a message for all of us. And Marty, the 20-year trends on how Americans are spending their times, the 20-year trends on how Americans are spending their time says that we're going in the opposite direction. We spend more time in the home, about an hour and 40 minutes a day, more in the home now than we used to. We also spend less time with other people in the home or outside the home. So the power of the group, peer power, not just peer pressure, peer power, I think it's something that, you know, we all need, and we especially need now.
I'm assuming that's, and we're up on a break here, but that's in part because of the pandemic, that so many of us did go home, in a sense we're allowed to go home and have struggled to get ourselves back into the world. But let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Angela Duckworth is our guest today on The Connection, and she studies human nature, studies successful people. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, she's got this brand new book we've been talking about, and it's titled Situated, Find the People and Places That Bring Out Your Best. And it's about who and what we surround ourselves with and how that can help us move beyond some of the issues and events that get us stuck. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Angela Duckworth is our guest. And again, she's got this new book, Situated, that we've been talking about. And it's in many ways an exploration of the power of our environments, who and what we surround ourselves with, and how that can help us reach some of our goals. I should say to our listeners during the break, just picking up on what we were talking about right before the break, the fact that the pandemic sort of forced so many people inside, and now how do we get people outside? You're saying it's even worse than that.
Yeah, these trends about Americans spending more time alone, and more time in their homes, that actually precedes the pandemic. It's about a 15 or 20-year trend, Marty. Mm. And by the way, it's not just that we're staying at home to work. We're staying at home to exercise. We're staying home to entertain ourselves. We're staying at home to eat. All of the major life functions, we're doing more alone, more at home. And in a very recent study, it turns out that for every year for the last 15 or so years, we have been speaking 300 fewer words per day.
Out loud.
Out loud, of course, to other people.
Right.
Sometimes it's called, you know, we're living in the antisocial century. And I want to say that the default settings of modern life are not great. That, to me, underscores the urgency to, where you can, change your situation. If you allow the default settings to rule your life, you will not eat the way you should, you will not sleep the way you should, you will not socialize or work the way that brings out your best.
Well, you talk about the importance of peers, of having people in our lives, that that's part of the situation. Your mom was a good example of that, which is, you know, now she's got people who are supporting her painting. But at the same time, how do we bring people in our lives that are going to support us?
You know, the message of the book really is that the situation should not always be something you consider to be fixed, because whoever you are and whatever your level of privilege, right, I believe there's something that you can change. I think small changes can lead to a kind of flywheel effect. You know, here's one very small physical change that my mom made to her circumstances that did lead to more profound changes that included other people. So when my mom was 87 and she had lived through this snorkeling accident, and, you know, she had the time in her life then, because my father had passed, and so she didn't have to perform all of her many wifely duties, she knew that she wanted to be that artist, and she walked down the hallway of her retirement home, which, by the way, is the quadrangle, you know, not far from where we're sitting, Marty, and she knocked on the door of the manager, and she made a request. I would like a second apartment. There was confusion. Why do you need a second apartment? What's wrong with your apartment? Nobody here has two apartments in the retirement home. And my mom, more or less to quote Virginia Woolf, said she needed a room of her own, a room where she could paint, where she could, as she puts it, mess up. It's a very small physical change. You could say, okay, so your mom got another room. Now she has a place to put her canvases. Right. It really did, though, have a kind of chain reaction effect. You know, she starts producing more art, you know, more resonance in the, you know, in the retirement home. Notice her art because it's on the wall. Oh my gosh, now she knows the neighbors who also care about art. By the way, let's both go painting. How about we take a trip to the Philadelphia Museum of Art? Last night, my mom introduced me to her new mentor. It's a ceramics teacher about 50 years younger than her, but the ceramics teacher knows things that she doesn't. I do think when we make one small change to our situation, it can have a flywheel effect. It can make our outcomes better, which in turn make the next situation better. And in that way, a small change can lead to something much more substantial.
You even talk about things like distance. You know, we're all obsessed with our phones, and we're on them much too much. And literally just putting your phone farther away, or you have an app that sort of delays the messages that you get. Those little things can help us sort of manage our environment, our space.
We are living in an age of digital distraction, but digital distractions require physical solutions. As a psychologist who not only studies grit, but self-control, in other words, avoiding temptation or resisting temptation, one of the singular findings of the last 20 years is that physical distance creates psychological distance. If you would like to be on your phone more, draw it close, keep it in your hand, take it to the bathroom, leave it on your nightstand to charge, which in my data is about 3 out of 4 adults in America. That's with Gallup, so it's representative. If you would not like to be on your phone first thing in the morning, last thing at night, and while you're in the bathroom, don't put it within 3 feet of you, because within 3 feet is within reach and within sight. I have asked this singular, I have asked a question of teenagers around the country, representative samples, sometimes in large school districts, where do you keep your phone while you're studying? The nearest choice is right by me, screen up, notifications on. The final choice is in another room, and there are choices in between. When you match that to academic performance, you find that the further the phone, the higher the GPA. So again, the simple solution to these digital distractions does not require a lot of 21st technology. It really is to move temptation away.
Well, in fact, reading from your book, want to read more books? Keep more books on your nightstand. Watch less TV, cancel a streaming subscription. Eat healthier, put a bowl of fruit on the kitchen counter. Snack less, don't buy snacks. I mean, you know.
And don't use willpower. I mean, Marty, in my data, and data, again, collected by other scientists, Americans are like all about willpower, right? You ask them, well, you know, how do you keep a healthy weight? Like, well, try hard not to eat junk food. Like, how do you, you know, you stay active? It's like, well, try hard to get to the gym. When I ask participants in my studies, what do you think is the best solution? They say you should change the situation. Yeah. When I ask them what they do, they say they use willpower. And then when I ask the follow-up question, why is that? They say, I want to be the sort of person who can overcome temptation through strength of will.
In fact, you write about a guy, Aaron Carroll, who's taking GLP-1s, obviously to lose weight. And there are apparently some other health benefits from that. But it made him feel ashamed that he was reliant on this drug to get him to be less obsessed about food and about eating.
Aaron Carroll has had a lifelong battle with his weight. So did his father. One could easily imagine, without genotyping them, that there might be a family disposition toward overeating and towards being overweight. And he always blamed his father secretly, he said, that, you know, if you just worked harder, you know, you wouldn't be this way. And he blamed himself. Now, this is a physician who understood the power of physiology. He would recommend to his patients that they go on GLP-1s. It was with great reluctance and with some shame that he made this change for himself. Wow. I consider that an act of courage, and I consider this an act of situational agency. If we could rebrand the idea of needing medication to regulate your metabolism, your appetite. He also, by the way, writes very courageously about being on antidepressant medication. You know, I'm sure there are lots of opinions about, you know, how much, is it good, etc. But I want to say that it is an act of courage to acknowledge that you need a situational fix to a psychological problem. And I really respect a physician like Aaron Carroll to say that so publicly.
Well, and this is getting back to asking for help, right? In certain ways, he was asking for help because willpower alone was not going to do it. And I think we know that the diets mostly fail because it's just so hard to stay on them, to deny yourself. Plus, we're surrounded by food all the time. I mean, we could walk a minute down the hall here and get ourselves a candy bar if we wanted.
I think that
temptation is everywhere, right?
You know, the modern environment is a mismatch for our evolutionary origins.
Right.
And I think that there is a message of hope here. I mean, you could say, like, well, then we're damned, you know, like here we are in a world where most of the calories that are offered to us are ultra processed. Or, mm-hmm. yeah, I want to be off my phone, but look around. I mean, walk through an airport or down the street. I mean, everyone's on their phone. There is power in changing, I think, your micro environment, right? Your situation that is your daily experience. Because, yeah, you can't uninvent social media. You can't change the way big food does big food. But we do have power. We know we reign supreme over our immediate circumstances.
The things that we can control. I mean, there's this, you know, what can and can't you control? And there's some things that we don't have control over.
I mean,
our DNA, for instance, or what we inherit from our folks.
I mean, you can make two lists. You can make a very long list of all the things you can't control, and you can make that list only about your situation. If you want to, like, skip DNA and so forth, you could just say, I can't move because I can't afford it. Like, I have to be in this job. I can't change. I cannot change my, you know, my in-laws. You know, whatever you want to list, you can make the list as complete as you want. I would encourage you to make a second list. And that list might be shorter. And that list may be where I keep my phone, where I charge it. It could be what I decide to keep in my refrigerator versus what I throw out. It could be something as simple as this. Do I want to put a post-it note that reminds me of a goal or a quote? My research suggests that a 2x2 yellow post-it note can actually make a difference because it will remind you of what you're trying to keep in mind. It will change your self-talk. That list may seem trivial. It may seem short by comparison, but I would encourage you to choose one item on that list, change it, do something about it, and see what happens.
You talk about culture. I mean, we this is the culture that we live in. You describe culture the way we do things around here, which I actually like that because it's so chatty and casual, but it does describe our behavior, our beliefs, how we operate in the world. But changing culture, you know, it's not just us, it's the whole world or our whole country.
I mean, culture is, by the way, you could write not only a paragraph, but a chapter on just defining culture, but it all adds up to the way we do things around here. You know, how do we dress? How do we eat? How do we, you know, talk to each other? And I think most people would put culture on the list of things that they can't change, right? Yeah. Like, how am I going to change American culture? Like, I don't like this culture that we're living in my city or at my workplace. And I'm not telling you that you can wave a magic wand and change culture at large. I do think you can, if you are an individual, choose your culture. I mean, you can move. We talked about status quo bias, Marty. Right. When you ask economists, what is the single most highly leveraged thing that a person can do to change their financial circumstances, they will say to change their zip code, to make a move. Now, again, I'm not saying
easy to do.
Not easy to do. Many reasons why you can't. But one thing that economists like Raj Chetty at Harvard would want everyone to know is that it's not always moving from the lowest income zip code to the highest one. It can be a move of a few blocks or a few miles. The summary insight of Raj Chetty's research on economic mobility is that your situation is hyper-local, as he puts it. Hmm. And it can be that in a few blocks you change your school district. It can be that in a few blocks you change your neighborhood. I mean, you can walk through Philadelphia and within a few blocks see that the whole neighborhood has changed. And, you know, that's not, I think, to say, like, that's a policy prescription for everything. Like, you know, we've now solved everything because now just moved to a good neighborhood. But I do think it's a singular insight that our circumstances do shape our future. And when we talk about the things that we can't change, like American culture at large, we may be ignoring the things that we can change, like the places in this country where I spend the most time.
How we do things around here, right?
How we do things around here. And I have to add this one finding, because when I learned it, I was like, that makes so much sense. And yet, holy smokes.
Yeah.
If you look at cell phone records, because, like, you know, because people are keeping their cell phones with them at all times, you can really know basically where people are. People spend the vast majority of their time within 5 miles of where they work or where they live. In other words, your whole life is hyperlocal. You are not living everywhere in this region. You are living in one tiny part of this region. You are working in one place. And if you do not like that place, move.
Let me ask you about the culture of work. And each workplace has its own culture, its own environment. How does leadership, or even the CEO, how does that person create, make a good culture, make a bad culture? How do you see that?
Leaders, I think, don't only choose their culture, they change their culture. And, you know, many leaders have heard, and I believe it's true, that it's important to have a why, the mission of the organization. What are we all working for? But organizations...
Why do we do what we do?
Why do we do things around here, right? Why are we doing what we're doing? But culture is the way you do things around here. Right. So in addition to having a why as a leader, you have to have a way. I mean, just because I am a Ted Lasso fan, I would just say, you know, the Richmond
believe,
way.
Right?
Yes, exactly. The Richmond way. There is a way they do things on Ted Lasso's team. There is a way every place works. And I think as a leader, you can ask yourself, okay, if it is my responsibility to create a situation that brings out the best in other people, physically, what are the objects that are within reach and within view? There is a physical dimension to the workplace. Are people working amid distractions? Do I have the Slack channel always on? Is the expectation that people should be monitoring their text messages? You know, what have I done to install reminders? If I think, like Ted Lasso does, that a physical sign with the value, for example, believe, like, if I think that's helpful to decorate the physical space that way, perhaps I should. I need to mention Wegmans because there are a lot of Philadelphians and others who are fans of Wegmans. I count myself among them. There is this poster. You could call it cheesy. It does have rainbow coloring. It says who we are at the top. It has the 5 core values of Wegmans supermarkets in the middle. I interviewed Tim Risser. He's the general manager of the Malvern branch of Wegmans. And he pulls this poster out. You know, he's got like a, you know, a pocket-sized version of it. And I'm like, Tim, come on. I mean, every company, every leader likes to kind of, you know, put cheesy posters on the wall. Sometimes they're rainbow colored. And he stopped me short. He said, and with some emotion, he said, we really, really live these values. Huh. And I think the message to me is you can shape a culture. Yes, seemingly trivial things like posters, quotes, you know, visible reminders of what you're trying to do, I think they matter. And then more than that, the way you do things at Wegmans is to have high expectations. That is one of their core values, but also it's a deeply caring culture. The way things are done at Wegmans is, as Tim would, you know, as his own personal example would say, for example, when I was, you know, rising in the ranks, my wife, Katie, went into labor. My first thought was, like, how am I going to cover the shifts? Where he calls his regional manager, and they're like, Tim, what are you doing talking to us? Get to the hospital. There is a way they do things around there. And I will just say, as a customer who walks in, I'm like, it's palpable, and it's changed Tim's life. And I think it changes the lives of everybody else who works in that positive culture. So leaders have a situational responsibility. They have an opportunity to have a why, but every why needs a way.
That's Angela Duckworth, our guest today on The Connection. Thank you very much for joining us. And I'll add one more thing, the importance of mentors. That is certainly part of what she writes about in her book. It's called Situated, Find the People and Places That Bring Out Your Best. And again, she's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. You can check us out on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. And you can always sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks again for listening.